You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Robert Bound. Coming up in the next hour, we'll get an update on the latest saga to hit Latin America, Argentina's grab of the country's biggest oil company. Is this an indicator of more nationalizations to come? We'll chat with the emerging markets editor at the Financial Times. And is the new American TV series Girls a sex in the city for the new recession-hit generation? We'll speak with Andrew Wallenstein, TV editor for Variety magazine. And in North Korea, hundreds of thousands of people reside in massive prison camps. Shin Dong-hyuk is the first person to have been born in a camp and to escape. Blaine Harden has written a book on this remarkable story, and he'll join us here in the studio to talk about it. And finally, Monocle 24 producer Katie Bilboa was at Salone del Mobile in Milan last week. It's the world's largest furniture fair, and as we'll find out later, it's not just chairs. The whole city was buzzing.
Dance is using the body, and people that are working in the design field doing objects are working with body at the same time.
All that plus a song or two and a global affairs chat with our very own Steve Bloomfield right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. Sounds like a wonderful show, but first, it's news time with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The frontrunner in the French presidential elections, François Hollande, today slammed French President Nicolas Sarkozy at a campaign rally a day after he bagged the lead in the election race after the first leg of voting. Hollande won 28.63% of votes, a shade above Sarkozy's 27.18%. Given Hollande's current position in the race, he looks set to win the final contest, but much will depend on which way far-right National Front voters choose to swing after their record 18% showing in the first round made them potential kingmakers. It wasn't enough to take the National Front candidate Marine Le Pen into the final round of voting on May the 6th, but Matthew Warren, business editor with TV channel France 24, told Monocle analysts had consistently underestimated her.
Not only has she done better in percentage terms than the Front National ever before, including when her father did so well in 2002, but if you look at the number of votes, she's over 1.5 million more votes than that historic level. So it's a very, very strong, showing for her, and I think definitely that was the biggest shock of the night.
Anas Behring Breivik, the man who killed 77 people last summer to protest Muslim immigration to Europe, has said he believed he could tell the ideology of his prospective massacre victims by looking at them, and spoke of his plans to steal a plane to fly to Utoyo Island. Speaking on the sixth day of a trial, he explained how he picked off whom he called Marxists with his rifle and pistol while passing over a young man he thought looked conservative. Psychologist Paul Grundahl, who's been listening to Breivik's testimony, said his confidence appeared to fall apart under questioning.
When the prosecutor confronts him that how are you supposed to take an airplane when you're not able even to reverse a car, then we see a Behring Breivik who is struggling to maintain his high sense of self-image. He doesn't like those kind of confrontations.
The European Union has agreed to suspend most of its sanctions against Burma for a year in recognition of sweeping democratic reforms after half a century of military rule. The decision comes into effect later this week and was taken by EU foreign ministers at a meeting in Luxembourg. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has tendered his government's resignation in a crisis over budget cuts, creating a political vacuum in a country which strongly backed an EU fiscal treaty and lectured Greece on getting its finances in order. In a statement, Rutte said he had offered his minority coalition's resignation to Queen Beatrix after a split with the populist Freedom Party, which had backed his government for the past 18 months, opening the way for elections possibly as early as June. The EU expressed optimism that the Netherlands will remain focused on cutting its budget deficit despite the crisis and suggested that fiscal goals were not set in stone.
The European Commission trusts that the Dutch government will continue to seek budgetary solutions that are important for the country and for the welfare, first and foremost, the welfare of Dutch citizens.
EC spokesman Amadeo Altafai. Activists said today Syrian forces have shelled a district of the central city of Hama and opened fire on residents, killing at least 20 people. The incident is said to have occurred in the Arbaeen neighbourhood, a day after United Nations observers monitoring an 11-day-old ceasefire agreement visited Hama, hotbed of popular revolt against President Assad. US President Barack Obama, meanwhile, will announce sanctions later today on those helping Syria and Iran acquire technology that lets them target dissidents through their cell phone and internet use. In a speech last night, he voiced his support for the people of Syria.
That despite all the tanks and all the snipers, all the torture and brutality unleashed against them, the Syrian people still brave the streets. They still demand to be heard. They still seek their dignity. The Syrian people have not given up, which is why we cannot give up.
And hundreds of Bahraini protesters clashed with riot police today after the funeral of a protester who was found dead at the weekend. Protesters threw petrol bombs and stones at a police station in the district of El Bilad El Qadim in the capital Manama after 15,000 people took part in the funeral of Salah Abbas Habib. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Nick Kelly. We'll have more from Nick at half past the hour. Right now, it's 6 past 6 p.m. here in London, and you're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, no chican des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. And last week, Argentina's president, Cristina Fernandez, announced that the country would renationalise YPF, the Latin American nation's largest oil company. The Spanish group Repsol was ousted in an instant, bringing out a diplomatic row between the two governments. The move was a reminder to the markets that the days of nationalisation in developing countries are far from over, particularly when it comes to the oil and gas industries. In fact, as we'll speak about now, resource nationalisation is going strong. To discuss why this is happening, we're joined now on the line by Stefan Wagstall, the FT's emerging markets editor. Hi, Stefan.
Hi.
Now, that was a long intro, which gave us a bit of backstory to Cristina Fernandez's action. But you've written a piece in the FT recently that says that this is far from uncommon, especially in that part of the world. And she talked about that in a speech she made. Can you give us a bit of an overview of the other people that have renationalised their kind of oil and gas industries?
Yes, I mean, you have a range of options, and Argentina is clearly at the extreme, full nationalisation, and we've heard today without compensation. We've seen moves in the last decade in Venezuela, for example, in Ecuador. We've seen in another way, the Brazilian state increasing its influence in its oil sector through Petrobras. But it's not restricted to that part of the world. In Russia, the state has reasserted its control over the oil and gas, particularly over the oil sector, in the last decade after the rather chaotic, in their view, developments of the 1990s. It's a theme, it's a trend which tends to coincide with rising commodity prices, because that's when the owners and controllers of resource assets feel strong. Because they have mining and oil companies banging at their doors. Of course, during periods of weak commodity prices, the opposite happens, and the governments controlling such resources are pushed into giving greater and greater concessions. And that's what's happening now, I think.
And, how much has Fernandez sort of claimed it as a sort of boost to national pride, as in a bit of flag-waving and symbolism?
Oh, to an enormous extent, and it has gone down very well in Argentina. This is a very popular move. We mustn't look at this from the point of view of just the foreign companies, who of course don't have a vote in Argentina. From the point of view of our own supporters, this is good news. And there are plenty of people in Argentina who will argue that Repsol, the Spanish company that has lost these assets, was neglectful of its investments in Argentina and wasn't doing its bit and so on, and that the government will prove to be a better owner of these assets than the Spanish company. Now, the history, and this is rather mixed, in general, government ownership has often been inefficient, but one can point to examples where it hasn't. In Norway, for example, the state oil company there has generally had a very good track record, and some of the oil companies working in the Middle East, the state oil companies, have also developed positive records over the years, I would say often in partnership with foreign companies. So this isn't black and white, but the starting point for Argentina, which is full nationalization and no compensation, is certainly very bad from a market point of view.
And will Argentina's neighbours be looking at this and looking at the commodity prices and seeing the political capital that's been made out of this and having some longish meetings themselves about this?
I'm sorry, will who?
Will Argentina's neighbours be having some sort of lengthy discussions about whether they should follow suit? I know in Brazil it's a sort of fairly similar situation with Petrobras, isn't it? But will it set a precedent? We wonder whether it might trigger a domino effect.
I don't think so. I think Argentina is an outlier in Latin American policymaking. That even those leaders like Hugo Chavez, who've had a very state-first policy towards the economy, have been rather more careful than she has. In Peru and Ecuador, we now see various moves to increase the role of the state in natural resources industries. But in none of these do we see the likes of Argentina. And we've seen quite a lot of criticism, particularly from Mexico, of Argentina's move. So I would see this in its own terms as a one-off in terms of an outright nationalization on this scale. But if you're talking about renegotiating and changing tax regimes, licensing regimes, yes, we'll see more of that. And that's the ebb and flow that goes with whether commodity prices are stronger or weaker. And when they're stronger and when resources seem to be short, that's when we see these management regimes changing.
And we always feel, possibly in the West, that big government is always expensive. I mean, I guess this isn't a sign of big government per se. It's just a reclaiming of natural assets and a bit of flag waving, I guess, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the issue for Argentina is, okay, having done this, there's a question about compensation. They say they're not going to pay. The longer term question is, can they really manage these assets better for the country than Repsol? Now, to do that, they will pretty much have to buy in technology and expertise and bring in foreign capital because they don't have it themselves. So the question is, who will it come from? Repsol has warned companies that if they step into its shoes, they will be sued along with the Argentine government. Well, at the moment, that's a threat, and there are ways around. One can construct agreements, maybe, that will avoid that threat. But still, it will be a tricky place for other companies to go, and therefore a difficult time for Argentina to seek alternatives.
And just before we go, I mean, does Argentina have a history of sort of reinvesting in the fields and the technology that it needs to really do justice to this decision?
No, especially as these deposits are at the cutting edge of technology. This is shale gas, which very few companies yet know how to do. The expertise is very much at a premium. The industry is in its early days. Argentina needs to be in the mainstream to benefit from the knowledge and technology, not to be cutting itself off in this way.
All right. Well, Stefan, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Okay. Pleasure.
That was Stefan Wagsell, Emerging Markets Editor for the Financial Times. And you're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
And you are back with Midori House live from Studio One here on Monocle 24. And we're going to play a track of music now to take us to the latest HBO TV sensation. Four Single Girls in New York City. Remind you of anyone? While you're thinking about that, here's Oland. And that was Oland, and that was Human by Oland, who's a Dane who moved to Brooklyn to pursue her career, which is kind of like the four protagonists of the show we're going to talk about now. Everyone's talking about it, apparently. No surprise, given it's a new HBO series and about the sex lives and friendships of four 20-something women in New York. Sound familiar? If you think Girls sounds similar to Sex in the City, you might be a bit off, though. Girls is considered bleaker, sharper, and more explicit, kind of like Sex in the City for the recession-era generation. Several critics are claiming the show has captured the zeitgeist, that dreaded word. To see whether this is true or if it's just another example of media hype, we're joined now on the line by Andrew Wallenstein, TV editor for Variety magazine. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there.
So, Girls, there's been a lot of column inches devoted to it. My favourite quote, which I looked up while we were listening to that song, which is, "Lonely girls are going to come in their pants with laughter." I think that's the Hollywood Reporter wrote that. Is this true? Is it all hype? Is it all talk and no trousers?
Oh, well, I think it's somewhere in between. I think, you know, your comparison to Sex and the City is dead on. But in the sense, it's sort of the anti-Sex and the City. It drains any sense of fantasy or cuteness that made that show so appealing. And in its own right, becomes just as appealing by being sort of this 180-degree opposite.
And this takes place, this isn't on the Upper East Side or on the trendier bits of the sort of emerging sort of West Village and meatpacking that Sex and the City took place in. This is very much a Brooklyn thing. Is it the pretty bit of Brooklyn, though, or is it genuinely quite gritty?
Oh, I think gritty is the right word. This show is really going for, I think, emotional terrain that is just completely different than that sort of glorified view of New York City that Sex and the City delivered.
And I understand this. This show kind of came from a little bit of a YouTube sensation. Lena Dunham sent something in to HBO, and it eventually was developed and turned into this. Is that sort of part and parcel of the vibe of the show, that it started off as a YouTube phenomenon?
Not quite. I would really root this more in an independent film phenomenon. Lena Dunham did a movie called Tiny Furniture that, at least here in the U.S., was quite a sensation in indie circles. I think that really sort of made her more of an indie film darling than a YouTube type. But, you know, I think the grittiness of the show is probably something that comes from both, you know, the internet and indie film.
And I wondered, you know, how you rate a success. I mean, we say everyone's talking about it, and it's got a lot of press, or quite a bit of press, in the UK as well, where it's not going to be on until perhaps Sky Atlantic film it or show it later in the year here in the UK. How is a success judged? Is it really by the Nielsen ratings, or is it to do with Twitter and what kind of blogs are writing about a show these days?
You know, that really is a great question, because the two standards of success here, at least after just one episode, couldn't be any different. Yes, as you pointed out, in terms of social media and press coverage, this show is kind of like American Idol. But the ratings for the first episode were actually pretty bad. We're going to actually get the second episode ratings probably in the next day or so, and I expect we'll see something of a lift. But there could not be a bigger difference between sort of the classical term of success in terms of audience reception and the kind of less tangible, buzzier sense that we get from the press and social media.
And I wonder whether how much that is part of it being simply on HBO. Obviously, you know, it's a channel that is subscriber only, so I suppose it can only, you know, it can 100% of HBO, what we have, people that have HBO can watch it, and it still won't be viewed as a sort of big hit because it's not on one of the franchise channels. Is that part of it?
You know, I'm not going to give HBO a pass on this because, yes, as you pointed out, HBO is really only available to about 30% of the populace that bother to subscribe. But even within that 30% footprint, HBO is very much capable of getting a TV show to do a decent rating. And by HBO standard or any standard, the ratings for the first episode of Girls just wasn't good.
And I don't want to cast aspersions at all, Andrew, especially as the TV editor for Variety magazine. I wonder sometimes whether you have as many really great promo DVDs to sit through as maybe we sometimes do in the UK. And you can take that as you will. But are a lot of Americans who maybe don't normally watch the TV actually loving this because they actually finally have something that is vaguely up their street and is on a channel that suits them?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for this show really seems to be laser targeted to sort of the chattering classes, shall we say, you know, the kind of media folk that appreciate a show that's really kind of gritty and nuanced and not the kind of thing that's going to be a big deal in the mainstream sense of the word. Still, I think we're going to see some growth from the show in the coming weeks as the chatter in these, you know, media circles starts to have kind of a ripple effect. And will the show be as big as, say, Game of Thrones? No, never. But I think the show will develop a extremely loyal cult following.
And just to give some of the, I say, backroom staff, he's obviously a huge name, but it's sort of exec produced by Judd Apatow, isn't it? And a lot of people have sort of seen his creative paw prints on it. I mean, is that sort of the mark of a success if someone sending in their tape to HBO, if his hands are on it, they can be guaranteed a hit? Or, you know, is stuff touched by him critic proof?
You know, I think nothing's critic or success proof entirely, but when you have a name like Judd Apatow, who's quite literally the king of comedy in the U.S. if we had such a designation, you know, I think that really does send a message to viewers that this is going to be something quality. And I think this kind of show really does fit into the sensibility that he's put out through the many, many movies that he's worked on over the years.
And just finally, the four girls that are the protagonists in the sitcom, they're cool, they're edgy, they live in Brooklyn. Would any of them actually have a TV to watch the show on themselves?
Probably not. I actually grew up in New York in the 20s myself, and I feel like I know these girls. Like, I remember them from when I lived there, and they were just the types that not only wouldn't subscribe to HBO, but wouldn't bother to have a television.
All right. Andrew Wallenstein, TV editor at Variety, thank you so much for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to try and kind of keep on theme now. We're going to play a bit of slightly gritty. She was back in the 80s anyway. This is Ordinary Girl by Alison Moyet. And as Nick Kelly said, you don't get a lot of Alison Moyet these days. That was Ordinary Girl. We were trying to keep in the theme with Gritty in Brooklyn, but we got Gritty and we got Alison. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll speak with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield to see what to look for in this month's edition of the magazine, now on newsstands. And we'll speak with our author Blaine Harden about the journey of one young North Korean from prison camp to freedom. And we'll hear from Monocle 24 producer Katie Bilboa about her busy journey to Milan's Salone del Mobile last week. But first, here is Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Rob. President Nicolas Sarkozy has hammered home pledges to get tough on immigration and security as he sought to win over record numbers of far-right voters and whittle down socialist François Hollande's narrow first-round election lead. Anish Behring Breivik, the man who killed 77 people last summer to protest Muslim immigration to Europe, has said he believed he could tell the ideology of his prospective massacre victims by looking at them, and spoke of his plans to steal a plane to fly to Utoya Island. The European Union has agreed to suspend most of its sanctions against Burma for a year in recognition of sweeping democratic reforms after half a century of military rule. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has tendered his government's resignation in a crisis over budget cuts, creating a political vacuum in a country which strongly backed an EU fiscal treaty and lectured Greece on getting its finances in order. An Icelandic court has found a former Prime Minister innocent of three major charges of negligence related to the country's 2008 economic collapse and guilty of a small count that carried no prison sentence. Activists said today that Syrian forces shelled a district of the central city of Hama and opened fire on residents, killing at least 20 people. Hundreds of Bahraini protesters clashed with riot police today after the funeral of a protester who was found dead at the weekend. Iran is investigating a suspected cyber attack on its main oil export terminal and on the oil ministry itself. A virus was detected inside the control systems of Kharaj Island, which handles the vast majority of Iran's crude oil exports. Chief financial officers and heads of cargo at the world's airlines reported growing confidence in their profitability and an improved outlook for the next 12 months, according to a survey by the International Air Transport Association released today. And China intends to increase bilateral trade with Germany to $280 billion by 2015. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. We'll get Nick to administer.
I won't say profitability again, I'll tell you that.
You should have tried nationalisation. That's rather a difficult one. We won't have to use either of those words in the next half hour because Steve Bloomfield's here.
What, you saying I'm not going to use the word profitability or nationalisation?
I dare you not to. Damn, I might have just lost my bet.
Yep.
Anyway, it is now time to. I was going to sort of read the bit of my cue.
Oh, sorry.
First,
well, yeah, no, go on. No, read it.
You
read
know
it.
What? I think the readers know the score. It's the new issue of Monocle is out on newsstands now.
It is.
Steve's going to take us through section A of that. Can I just? I know you've got some things post-it noted in your. Not physically, but in your memory, in your great
memory,
Steve,
yeah.
Of what happened this month in the magazine. But I wanted to tell you what my favourite bit is.
Oh, yeah, go on then.
It's page 64, which is a donkey walking into a condom. Can you explain that story for us, please, first?
So, there was a lot of discussion about this. As illustrations go, and debates about illustrations go, none has been as fierce as the one over, let's call it Donkey Gate.
Okay.
I was going to say something worse, but I'm not going to say that. It is, yes, a donkey walking into a condom and quite a large...
I think the donkeys... This is Sacha Eisenberg's column, is it? I think this possibly is the Democratic logo.
It is.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a reason for it. We haven't just decided to put donkeys and condoms on for no reason.
It's not sexy, Monocle. What can you do about that?
I don't know. A donkey... Anyway. the story is about... he has a monthly column, The View from the Campaign Trail, all the way up to November and the election. And his piece was all about how social issues, which have always been good for the Republicans, good divisive issues about, you know, abortion, so on, gay marriage, are actually now proving to be good for the Democrats. And he uses as an example a debate within the Republican Party about contraception, which has backfired for them. So our illustrators decided the best way to demonstrate this pictorially would be to have a donkey stepping into an enormous condom.
That's good. Well, see, that's the beauty of illustrations, because imagine if they'd had to have what you just said as a caption.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it sort of sums up the story in a... No, well, it's... Anyway, there was some debate about it. But
so
it got in. It got past the... It got past Mr. B upstairs.
The powers that be.
Mm.
And talk us through some of the other stuff. Star Leader is always good.
Star Leader, yes. And this month we've got two Star Leaders for the price of one. Not just Xi Jinping, who is the man who is almost certain to become the next leader of China, but also his wife, Peng Li Yuan, who, as well as being his wife, is also a folk singer, quite a famous folk singer in China.
Yeah, she's been illustrated beautifully in our sort of trademark style for star leaders.
Yeah.
And she's wielding a microphone and wearing what looks like she's sort of mugged a rear admiral on the way to the yeah. stage there. She's got a nice military uniform on.
Well, she's in the military, so she performs in this military uniform, whereas he is a little bit more sort of, as you can imagine, sort of a black suit.
Boxy suit.
And, and normally a red tie. And also, of course, black hair, because you can't have grey hair if you're a Chinese leader.
Terrible sign of weakness.
Yes. In fact, if you're any sort of leader in a certain part of the world, Hosni Mubarak was, 82, 83?
Not a grey hair on his head.
Not a single one there. So it is a very good star leader, double star leader, written by Justin Bergman. Alongside that, we've got Mark Leonard, who's the author of a book called What Does China Think? Who is looking at what the new Chinese leadership might be like, obviously, particularly in light of everything that's happened with Bo Xilai. So that's all good. There's a really interesting interview with...
just think it's up to our readers to see if it's good or not, Steve.
No.
That's sjb@monocle.com if you want to critique any of
these. It's very interesting. with the CEO of Norway's investment bank, who is responsible for Norway's government pension fund, or the oil fund, which is basically where they keep all the oil money.
I wish I was Norwegian sometimes.
Yeah, they get quite a good deal.
They do, don't they?
Huge amounts of oil, and not many people.
They don't fill their swimming pools with it. This isn't a leisure topic. I mean, it's just I think you could sort of be on the dole and sort of be what the wealthiest man in England possibly, couldn't you?
Essentially, that's what seems to happen. So yeah, and then two other things just to say very quickly. One is the big report on twin cities, inspired by we've been talking a lot about Copenhagen and Malmo. So we did a big story about how those two cities work together. Beautiful picture of the bridge between the two. And also within that, we also talked about some other twin cities, my favourite, which is Brazzaville and Kinshasa in the two Congos. They are the only capital cities where you can see another capital city.
Oh, I like that. Place. I like that sort of place.
So you can be
not just because it's a high building.
Yeah, yeah, no, indeed. So you can be on the banks of the River Congo in Kinshasa and look over, and there's Brazzaville. But
looking over
to
the end
lead,
of the desk,
yes,
is Ed Stocker. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you very much.
You've written a great piece on Haiti. And the setup for this is it's time for Brazil to take command of the UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti. Obviously, Steve commissioned you to do this piece. You could talk amongst yourselves, but we'll try and. I wanted
Thanks.
To kick off actually by asking you, what the Brazilian, if there is a Brazilian star that's different to that of slightly more kind of militaristic nations that you might think that have done that job.
I don't know. It's something they like to put across, I guess. They certainly think they've got more in common with Haiti than perhaps other nations. In terms of culture and some of the difficulties that the country has. And also just being around the barracks as well, they seemed, obviously there was lots of discipline, as you'd expect, but there was also, they seemed to be a sort of certain sort of laid-back Brazilian charm to the whole thing, and definitely the way the different soldiers and people interacted with each other was perhaps not what you might expect in... I don't know, from other nations, shall we say, possibly.
mention unnamed.
What's interesting about this story as well is that, Brazil, under their last president, Lula, were very keen to prove that they could be a global superpower, they could take on a role within the UN. And so this was sort of a test case for them to see whether they could really do it. And so they sent a couple of thousand troops there. They've got the commander who's in charge of the whole mission. And since Lula's gone and Dilma Rousseff has taken over, they've had a slight change in their foreign policy, and they're talking about leaving. They're not quite sure whether this is what they want to do. But I mean, as Ed found when he was there, I mean, they really have sort of had some sort of impact there.
They certainly have. I mean, they do seem, having wandered around with them, they do seem popular. From the smallest of things, Haitians are mad about football. You see,
they couldn't be peace kept by a better nation. Then,
well, exactly. Yeah. There you go. I mean, you see murals of all the Brazilian players on public transport, on walls. So they have certain on different levels. They seem to seem to get on fairly well, but obviously there's still certain controversies there, which you can't escape. But
is there that sort of base level of goodwill, which does extend to football? Clearly, is an important ambassadorial peacekeeping thing when it's clearly such a famous part of another nation's kind of resume. Is it the small things like that, from your experience writing this story, that really make a difference, rather than and a bit more of a sort of different countenance?
It's an easy way, isn't it, to form a common bond between two different nations, is those sorts of things. So it's a way of kind of bonding with the two nations, bonding with that away from some of the grittier things that they have to deal with, away from the more hardcore security missions and things like that that are also a day-to-day part of the mission. So I think it is important, yes.
All right, Ed, Steve, thank you very much for your time, Midori House. Seemed quick, didn't it?
We shouldn't have
kicked off with the donkey and the condom thing. That took a while to justify, didn't it? Anyway,
I felt like I had to at least explain why there was a massive picture of a condom in my section.
Exactly, in case someone wrote in.
With a donkey walking into it.
Indeed. Well, thank you both for joining us on Midori House. Stay with us. We're going to hear what Katie Bilbao got up to at Salone in a minute.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better. Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
It is 43 minutes past the hour here in London. I'm Robert Bound with you until 7 o'clock, when it's time for the Culture Show, normally produced by Katie Bilboa, who was at the Salone del Mobile in Milan last week. It's where the top designers and manufacturers from across the globe gather for a week to display their latest products and search out new and exciting ideas. And it's not just the enormous conference centre which houses the fair that's been brought to life during Salone. The whole city is buzzing with events, previews, shows and parties. And while design is always at the centre of the week, the passion for a good chair is spilling over into the world of culture too, as our producer Katie Bilboa found out last week.
There was one event happening at this year's Design Week in Milan, which even the most seasoned and committed Salone veteran may have been surprised by. Design Dance, which took place at the Triennale Cultural Centre, is an intriguing fusion of the arts. 456 objects from the history of Italian design explained through theatre and interpreted through dance and acrobatics. Not your usual Salone del Mobile event. Co-writer, producer and director Francesca Molteni explains the thinking behind the show.
Design is made by connections. And so you have to connect and bring objects in connection with other things, other literature, cinema, or what is art, of course, because design is project. Most of the design objects are projected by men and women that would like to change the world, the way we live. And so why don't we put these nice dreams of men and women on a stage and make them the actors and players of this show?
Francesca comes from a family of designers.
Design is in my DNA because my grandfather was producing furniture. My father, my sisters and brothers are all in the production field, in the design field. I studied philosophy and then started as a director for TV, for the Italian TV, doing documentaries at the beginning about art, history, and then about design too. So when I met Michela, I said, it's wonderful. She's from not far away from my small village where I grew up, just outside Milano, in Brianza, in the wonderful place where so many objects are done since 50, 60, 80 years. So we are not in the design field in a specific way, but we both grew up with the same air, things from wood and from people doing things with hands. That's another point of interesting for us. Dance is using the body, and people that are working in the design field doing objects are working with body at the same time.
The team were able to amalgamate a huge collection of objects from top Italian designers, as Michela Marelli, the other half of the duo behind the production, explains.
We choose all the objects we like, and we don't suppose all the objects we ask for they will be given to us. And when everybody says, oh yes, we were glad to give you all our objects, and would you like some other objects? And we have these objects, would you like it? We were quite surprised, really afraid, and start to write again the show, starting exactly from them. We put all the picture of objects on a table, and they cover the whole table and try to find what there is behind them. Geometry, or like the idea of sedia, or we try to find what image they give us. And then with all the ideas we had, we wrote a play which starts from movement, from the movement of the object. Words came after.
The broad range of objects in the show includes everything from Gaetano Pesce's infamous 60s up chair to more contemporary items such as Francesco Gomez Paz and Paolo Rosato's 2009 Hope chandelier. For the design dance team, translating the form of these hundreds of objects into performance has been a collaborative process. Francesca Molteni again.
We worked with dancers, actors, music players, and many, many other technicians, video makers that help us give a form to this kind of very strange material because it was in between all the arts. So it was really made by different people that believed the idea was very good and was fantastic, the title, Design Dance, and was so full of energy, of life, the possibilities inside the show that they gave us really the energy to go on and to believe it.
Are they the original objects?
Yeah, all the original one, and we forgive everybody to change them because they want to have the original objects and use them as they were created and break many of them.
Have you broken any then in the process?
Some of them.
And what happens when you break them?
We will know at the end of the show what happened to these objects. Many of them are very, you know, desired by our actors, technicians. Oh, I would like a sacco. Now anybody knows the names of these strange chairs or sofas. They were nothing for these people. You know, it's a learning process too. And now they call with the name of the object, not a chair, but, you know, a superleggera. Give me that, pass me that. It's wonderful. We are teaching a design to many different people.
Francesca and Michela are hoping they can tour the production around the world. And while contemporary dance might not be everyone's bag, the Salone audience was certainly entertained. For Monocle, in Milan, I'm Katie Bilboa.
Thank you very much, Katie Bilboa. We'll be speaking to Blaine Harden, author of the North Korean escape drama. It's a real-life escape drama, Escape from Camp 14, after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no chican des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you are tuned in to Midori House. Now, no one born into a North Korean prison camp has ever managed to escape, except that is Shin Dong-hyuk, born in Camp 14 in the province of Pyongyang. After seeing his mother and brother executed, Shin decided to escape. Now he's a human rights activist and telling his story, which is laid out in shocking detail in a new book called Escape from Camp 14. Tomorrow, the London-based organisation The Frontline Club is hosting an event with Shin Dong-hyuk and author Blaine Harden, who wrote the book. And Blaine Harden joins us now in the studio.
Thank you.
Welcome
nice to
the
be
show.
Here.
And I read the preface and introduction to this book. It starts in an immensely shocking way, where Shin witnesses the execution of his mother and his brother. Does that act as the spur for him to escape, or is it sort of some years later that he kind of makes a bid for freedom?
Well, he had an immensely shocking life, all of it, and the execution of his mother and brother came when he was only 13, and he escaped a decade later.
And I suppose to kick off, we should try to work out how you met him, how his story came to your attention for you to collaborate on the book.
I was working for the Washington Post, covering North Korea, and I did a piece about Shin in December 2008, a story on the front page, but it had an enormous reaction from readers who wanted to help him, send him money to become his parent. So I went back to him and ask him to go deeper in the story and write a book. And he promptly said no. And he said no for about 9 more months until I could persuade him and human rights groups could persuade him that telling his story in depth would be good to raise awareness about what happens in the camps.
And was he reticent to tell his story because it was such a, you know, because it dragged up such awful details from his memory?
That's exactly right. I felt in doing 2.5 years of interviews with him like a dentist drilling without anesthetics.
And I'd like to point out that you're not smirking at that analogy
yourself
at all. And after he escaped, he had a quick transition. It took him, 2 months to get into China or to walk to China?
Just a month.
A month to walk into China.
He didn't walk all the way because it was quite a trip of 270 miles. But he rode some of it in a truck and much of it in boxcars.
And then he was in LA where he set up this human rights organization, and now he's settled in Seoul. In the south of that country, is he sort of regarded as a poster boy for what can be done almost in North Korea? Or is he possibly the one lone voice that has escaped?
Well, no. There are now 23,000 defectors from North Korea in South Korea. And in general, they do not get along very well because they're, in effect, coming from the Middle Ages into one of the most modern and career-obsessed economies in the world. So they feel just neglected when they get there. And Shin feels the same way in Seoul.
And I mean, so obviously, there's a lot of families that were cut in half by the partitioning of that country. Does he have family in South Korea, or is it sort of once you've been born in a prison camp as he was, is it impossible to trace your history pretty much?
So the country was cut in two a long time ago,
yeah.
And the families now with members on both sides are in their 60s and 70s. So that family connection between North and South is quite attenuated and getting more so with each passing year. Shin was told he had uncles who lived in South Korea, but he was never able to find them once he got there.
And I mean, from Shin's point of view, we hear when we see shots of, it was Kim Jong-il as was looking around factories and sort of we see these sort of, you know, properly communist, depleted, boring looking and certainly very bored looking, should I say, very hungry looking people. Could Shin believe it when he got to China, even let alone Los Angeles and then Seoul, what the rest of the world was like?
I ask him that question a lot. For him, the most shocking part of his escape was his first day outside the camp. He got through a fence, slept in a pigsty, and woke up in a small, dirty little town called Bukchang. And he walked around and he saw people who were laughing, people who were wearing brightly colored clothes and trading at a market, buying stuff. And for him to see people walking around without guards hitting them, telling them what to do, was for him the most profound revelation about what it meant to be human still.
And I mean, the controls within the camp were extremely tight. Did anyone watch even communist state television in that camp? Was there any knowledge of the outside world at all? I mean, was it literally like, you know, was it like someone kind of coming from the jungle almost?
It was like an alien fallen to Earth when he escaped the camp. He didn't know that television existed. He didn't know that Earth was round. He didn't know that China or South Korea existed until just a few weeks before he decided to escape. In fact, it was a newcomer to the camp who told him about the outside world that planted the idea that he should get out. Before that, he had considered this open-air cage to be his home.
And you must have felt almost like did you ever feel like a guardian, I wonder, in any way, when you were writing this book with him? Obviously, there are amazing sensitivities and levels of education and experience that you had far in extent to his own. Was it a tough process because of the difference between you two or your life experiences?
Well, in some ways, yes, but it was difficult because he very reluctantly tells his story. He hates to talk about the bad things that happened in the camp. So talking to him was like a glacial process of winning his trust and then finding details. And he's not a natural storyteller because he did not grow up with stories about anything. He grew up scrambling for food. So it took a very long time to get him to unreel his amazing story.
And I wonder, what was it like when you sort of first met him and mooted the idea of this book? I mean, you said that he was obviously very reticent to sort of spill the beans. But I mean, like, did you have to convince him? Did you feel a little bit guilty about that? Or obviously there was a higher purpose at work?
Well, I told him that if he told his story in all its detail, that he would be able to catch the attention of Americans and people around the world because his story is unique. And he didn't believe me for the longest of time. And he's only now beginning to believe me because the book is actually selling.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of books are similar to this I said in the introduction, possibly rather clumsily, that it's an escape drama. And we're so used to things like this that are fictional, based on true events. Something like this that's as grittily described as it is in the book, are pretty rare. You can't have had many texts to sort of work off. Presumably it was just his testament, was it?
Well, it's his testimony, but there's also been now 60 other people who've been in the camps over time, and they tell a very similar story about what the texture of life is like in the camps. But the fact that he was born in the camp, that his parents were chosen by guards, that he was basically created by guards to be a slave in the camp, these are new details that are new with Shin.
And there's something extra peculiar and sort of foreign to our way of thinking about someone that's born in a prison camp like this. I mean, maybe we should, for time's sake, briefly say this. I mean, how many other people are there in these camps in North Korea?
Now there are five camps, and it's estimated there are between 135 and 150,000 in the camps. They've existed for five decades, and 400,000 people are estimated to have perished in the camps.
All right. Well, Blaine Harden, author of Escape from Camp 14, thank you very much for your time here on Midori House. And thanks for tuning in. Coming up next, after the top of the hour and the news, is The Culture Show. Thank you for tuning in.